Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today, what college freshmen need to know about their first year on campus. But first, they're starting that year with some sobering news. The panel appointed by the governor of Virginia to investigate the April 16th massacre at Virginia Tech criticizes that university's response to the shootings and its failure to properly care for the mentally troubled student who killed 32 people and himself that day. The report says lives could have been saved had university officials not waited more than 2 hours to alert the campus to the initial shooting of two students. As we all remember, the gunman, Sungwhee Cho, went on to kill 31 other students and faculty members and himself inside a classroom building on the campus in Blacksburg. Well, Tim Craig is covering this story for The Washington Post. Tim, as we said, the report faults the university's response after the first two shootings, but does it go on to say a quicker response would have prevented the other shootings?
No, the report's quite clear. Although they believe lives could have been saved and a lot more things could have been done during that two-hour gap between the two shootings, it states that given Cho's history and Cho's intent to kill somebody that day, that there would have still probably been violence and bloodshed on Virginia Tech's campus on April 16th.
But perhaps less. Well, you spoke of his history. There had been questions about whether or not Virginia Tech didn't recognize the warning signs in this troubled student. What does the report say about that?
It paints a picture of a tortured young man almost from his infancy where he, you know, didn't talk. And he had a condition known as selective mutism.
What was that condition? Selective mutism?
Selective mutism. It's a sort of an anxiety disorder where people don't really communicate freely with others. And they are much the introverted and the reserved, and they tend to be antisocial. He also was diagnosed at an early age with depression. He was on medication for a while in high school, which seemed to work at the time. But then eventually he went off of it.
Well, what does the report say about his professors complaining about his classwork? What happened with that information?
Mostly starting in his junior year, he began writing some violent poems, violent writings. At different times, professors took this information to others within the university, but there was really no one looking out for the big picture for Mr. Cho. So a lot of times the ball was dropped, and even though he had, for instance, wrote a letter or a paper a year before the shootings talking about a school shooting, that information was never really given to the higher-ups in the university, and no one really did much about it, thinking it was much of a harm to other students.
Well, we also know that he at one point saw a judge who ordered him to get health care. What does it say about that?
There was an incident in the dorm where he made some threats, and the police took him to a psychologist for an evaluation. In Virginia, judges kind of serve as the gatekeeper to determine if somebody's a threat to themselves. The judge ruled he was a threat to himself and others, and he was hospitalized overnight in a psychiatric hospital. The next morning, another physician ruled that he could be released, but he should seek outpatient counseling at Virginia Tech's counseling center. Cho made an appointment that same day. Cho showed up that same day at the counseling center. But the report says the ball was kind of dropped because the counseling center did an evaluation of him, let him go, but there was never any follow-up, and Cho never returned. And that was his only interaction with a mental health professional.
Yeah, I mean, because the question had been, gee, how could somebody get away with not going to receive counseling once a judge has ordered them to do that? It turns out he did go to receive counseling.
He did show up for his initial appointment at Virginia Tech's Cook Counseling Center, and he was given another evaluation. The report questioned why he was given the three evaluations, or they call them triages, when what he really needed on that third time was actually somebody to sit down with him and begin treatment, but that treatment was never given.
Right. How is this report, which is a pretty damning one, reverberating there in Richmond?
People are going to look at it closely. I mean, there's a lot of issues in here. A big component of this report is the need to change privacy laws. You see a lot of different things where if only somebody else had known about something else earlier, somebody may have been able to put all the pieces together.
Well, change privacy laws or even be educated about existing laws. We understand the report says that some of the staff at the school didn't take any action with Mr. Cho because they thought they might be sued, and they wouldn't.
Yeah, the report goes into quite some detail about what actually the privacy laws say and what somebody can and cannot do, and they believe there's a lot of confusion out there, that some school officials may believe that they cannot do certain things, which really they can do. Now, would that have prevented the shooting? You know, no one knows for sure, but as people move forward, I think there's going to be a strong reflection on what the state and federal privacy laws say and how they interact with each other.
Tim Craig of The Washington Post covering the release of the state report on the April 16th massacre at Virginia Tech. You can read that report, by the way, by going to our website, here-now.org. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, in the wake of the Virginia Tech tragedy, thousands of students and employees at that school signed up for a new emergency alert system that will send them campus emergency alerts by email or instant messaging. Similar systems are being set up on other campuses across the country, including Boston University, where we are stationed. Montclair State University in New Jersey goes further. Students are given special cell phones to carry. They punch in a code when they, for instance, cross campus at night. If they don't punch out when they've arrived safely, a campus cop will come looking for them. Security. It's just one of the issues covered in the book Campus Confidential, The Complete Guide to the College Experience by Students for Students. Rob Miller is the editor, and we've asked him back to talk a little bit today about college freshmen in particular. Rob, I want to start with something new that we're hearing anecdotally and we're seeing in the news. Parents doing their own research on their children's roommates using Facebook or MySpace online chat rooms because kids put so much of themselves out there. In one case, reported by the Baltimore Sun, a parent actually requested that a school change the living arrangements for their child because a future roommate talked online about wanting a same-sex relationship. Now, we're actually putting together a report on so-called helicopter parents who may hover over their kids in college, but this is getting complicated.
And perhaps a little over the top, in my opinion. College is a time where students explore. It's sort of a rite of passage from childhood to adulthood. It's been a time when, you know, students get to campus, they feel a certain measure of freedom and a certain measure of safety with their roommates to explore certain things in their own ways. And I think that's an important part of the experience, and having parents check MySpace to determine whether a roommate fit is appropriate or not, I think, is a little scary, in my opinion.
Well, but you do write that there's a lot that kids should do. Let's talk about roommate relations.
Sure.
By now, they should already have been talking over the summer with their roommates to get to know them before they get there. But you also write, right after the parents leave, sit down and hold a suite-wide or roommate-wide meeting and talk about what?
Things like personal property and how it will be shared or not shared, how to handle joint costs in a suite, cleanliness and what that means, how you're going to handle overnight guests, boyfriends, mm-hmm. girlfriends, people from out of town, smoking, drinking, partying in your room, how the common space will be decorated, whether political views are going to be expressed in common space. That can be a big one for people. How you're going to respect each other's differences and how you're going to sort of let the air out of the balloon when the inevitable controversies jump up.
Well, and you're right that there's one question in particular that you should ask of your roommates. What is the most important thing I need to know and respect about you or your things that will help us get along?
Be open. Communicate and just find out, what are people's buzz issues? What is it that's going to set someone off, and how do you disarm that issue ahead of time so that people get really stressed around exam times, or, somebody has a particular difficulty with an ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, yeah. parent, whatever, and figuring out how to deal with those things.
Well, you mentioned drinking, and you give particular advice that has to do with security, for instance, and drinking. Don't drink from common sources. If someone's giving out Jello shots or, there's punch bowls, why?
More and more you hear stories of common source drinks being contaminated with drugs or certain other things.
Date rape pills, as they're called.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We also advise, if you're going to a party where you don't know the hosts personally, pair up, particularly if you're a freshman woman, and look out for each other and just make sure that one doesn't go home without the other.
Okay. There's so much in your book. I just want to tick through a couple more things. You say you're going to get a lot of offers as you head off to college as a freshman, but there's one you might want to look into, and which is if schools offer to sell you a computer.
Our advice in the book, we have a whole chapter on this, is take it easy in terms of everything you're asked to sign up for at the outset. But the one thing that seems to be a continuing good bargain year after year is computers. The schools typically strike deals with computer manufacturers where they get very attractive rates on laptops and desktops. And that tends to be one of the better bargains that's available.
And I'm participating in getting a computer for a college-bound niece. And we had to wait until the school told us what kind of software they wanted so she could interact with the school.
Follow the lead of what the school suggests. Mm-hmm. It can be very frustrating to have a software platform or a hardware platform that isn't supported.
All right, to the academics. You write that there should be a freshman year goal-setting workshop.
In talking with the other students that helped put this book together, one thing that we kept coming back to was at the beginning of every year, we do a goal-setting workshop. And it's basically a chapter, it's like a workshop in the book that forces you to take stock of where you are, think about what your academic and career goals are, what your social goals are, what your extracurricular, physical, and financial goals are for a particular year. And we ask you a whole series of questions under each of those categories to get you thinking, how can I get the most out of this year? What did I learn last year or as a freshman coming in? What did I learn in high school? And what do I want to do differently? You know, what do I want to focus on?
It's a chance to change, too. It's a chance to be the you you want to be.
Absolutely. You know, college is a time to reinvent yourself and to grow and evolve, and these workshops really kind of help to focus you on that, to think about your year on a macro scale, identify some goals, order your priorities, and then build some rationales for the goals that you've chosen, and then keep track of them.
You also say find a study place, practice the unwritten rules of college etiquette, don't gossip, don't mooch, practice safe sex, don't monopolize conversation in class, don't leave your dorm door propped open or give out your keys.
Yeah, important things. You know, yeah. If a college has, you know, locked entryway system, that locked entryway system is only as good as the students protecting their own security cards.
Okay, now that we've scared the bejesus out of everybody. Rob, one last thought. I mean, you're really pretty young looking yourself, and I'm just wondering, you know, it seems as if in this book you've wanted so badly to tell kids, you know, they have the big things, how to get financial aid, stuff, but the little things too. I mean, it's reminding me of that song. It's to the Desiderata. It was by an Australian named Buzz Lehrman. It's a Chicago columnist's advice to young people, you know, floss. Remember that song? Floss and be nice to other people and dance a lot. It seems like that's really what you're saying.
We wrote this book to help people get the very most they can out of college, to help them find the right school for their interests. And then once they get there, to really make the very most they can out of the 4 years. To that end, I'll close with a quote. It's from one of our mentors who went to Wellesley College. She says, "Allow yourself to grow and change. Challenge yourself, but be kind to yourself also. Know that what you do is important, but that it's nothing compared to who you are. Breathe in and breathe out. Temper periods of intense drive and activity with periods of reflection and rest. And above all, make peace with the fact that no one, including all of us in this book, can actually tell you what your own journey will be like or how you're meant to navigate it. Each of us gets to learn that as we go."
Rob Miller, and the book is Campus Confidential, The Complete Guide to the College Experience by Students for Students, and we just heard the words of one. Rob, thanks as always.
It's great to be with you, Rob, and thanks again for having me.
Put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's only with yourself. Remember,
the sunscreen song, Wear Sunscreen. A little levity there, and we need it today, because up next, a real and grim warning about swimming pools and hot tubs and kids getting trapped in the drain. Should there be a law? After the break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Summer is coming to a close, but we thought two stories about pool safety deserved attention, and we bring them to you with a warning. They are pretty grim. Last month, a 6-year-old boy drowned in 3 feet of water in his backyard pool when his arm got caught in the pool intake drain. And in June, a 6-year-old Minnesota girl had part of her intestinal tract torn out when she sat on an open drain at a public wading pool. It's rare. But between 1985 and 2004, at least 33 children died after getting caught in pool and hot tub drains, and nearly 100 have been injured. And child safety advocates say the numbers are probably higher because entrapment is often not listed as the cause of the drownings. And by the way, it's happened to adults as well. Well, Nancy Baker has made it her mission to prevent these deaths. She's with the group Save Kids. They're pushing for federal pool safety legislation. She also happens to be the daughter-in-law of former Secretary of State James Baker, and her daughter, Virginia Graham Baker, died in a hot tub at a children's party 5 years ago. Nancy, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Terrible story. You know, we have to start by saying we're so sorry for your loss. Can't imagine that this is, you know, easy for you to talk about. But do you mind telling us what happened on June 15th, 2002?
Yes, we had gone to a graduation party. My oldest daughter was graduating from high school, and our entire family was invited. There were about 100 people there, a neighborhood event, and all of my kids were in the pool, and I was on the deck, and at one point one of my kids ran towards me and said, "Mommy, Mommy, Graham is in the hot tub," and I looked over. It was attached to the pool, and I jumped in. This, you couldn't see underwater because of the bubbles, and it was dark water. Mm-hmm. And she was, I tried pulling her, and she was stuck on the drain.
You even had two grown men come and try to help you.
Well, once I had never heard of entrapment, so recognize I did not know what was holding her there.
Right.
And eventually, I mean, in terror and horror, I got out and screamed for help, and it took two men to pull her off, and when they did, it cracked the drain in half. The pressure is so huge.
This horrendous. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
And so hard to understand, you know, that a hot tub drain could have that much force, but I understand it's like when you hold your hand over a vacuum?
Yes. And what happens is the pump is, you know, obviously drawing water, you know, from the pool back to the pump and recirculating it. And if it's blocked by a body, by a toy, by anything else, and there's no longer water going through that pipe, it creates an air vacuum. And it holds a body, you know, with, you know, hundreds of pounds of pressure. I read about a man, a football player, who was in a hot tub with his son, and his son became entrapped, and he pulled the child off. But it when they brought him out, it a chunk of cement from the bottom of the pool, from the bottom of the hot tub, also came out. It's that kind of force.
Well, you know, as you didn't know this can happen, most people don't know this can happen, even though this story sort of percolates up every now and then. The Consumer Product Safety Commission lists pool and spa drains as one of the top five hidden home hazards for kids. And in Greenwich, where we mentioned there was recently that horrendous drowning, the pool industry has been holding seminars. Construction of new pools has been slowed up because they're now reviewing policy.
Yeah, they ought to review policy.
But that brings the question, what is the law? What are the requirements?
They vary all over the country. There is no consistent law or code that dictates how they should be built. It can be built, you know, with a single drain. The most dangerous scenario, and I'm sure that this is what occurred in Connecticut, and also where my daughter died, is that, you know, a single drain,
it has more power.
When a pool is or a spa is built with multiple drains, the pressure is diffused so that if one is blocked, water is still being drawn through another. Although there are studies that show that a pool with two drains or a spa with two drains, there is still enough pressure to hold a 50-pound child underwater.
Well, what about drain covers? You mentioned there was one in the hot tub. Is it required to have a drain cover, and why doesn't that protect from this force?
Well, there are flat drain covers which do nothing to protect, because, you know, all it takes is some large body part, and it creates a seal. There are new drain covers that are called anti-entrapment drain covers, and those are more effective in preventing entrapment. They're domed, and it's more difficult to cover the entire thing and create a seal. And the pool industry is indicating that if a drain cover is missing, the pool ought to be shut down. And that's the safety provision that they're recommending, which is not enough.
Well, pool manufacturers also seem to be saying that pool safety should be up to pool owners. You're pushing legislation named after your daughter that would require more fencing, more alarms around pools, but also pump shutoff switches, rounded drain covers in existing public pools. Now, we understand you can't add a second drain to an already existing pool. What is the pool industry saying about requirements?
The pool industry really is, you know, basically saying, if you put dual drains in, there's no need for this. You don't need one of these systems that will shut the pump down. You do. I mean, in fact, I've seen tapes of tests that show that that's only effective as long as both drains are working and as long as the covers are in place. Mm. And this is, you know, these things are grisly. I don't know how else to describe it. And this doesn't happen because people understand it. Mm. It happens because, just like the CPSC says, it's hidden, it's misunderstood, and there's an assumption that it happens to so few people it won't happen here. Mm. And look at the number of toys that there are on the market, you know, those rings that people throw into pools and tell kids to dive for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, where they go is straight toward the drains. It's almost luring them there.
Nancy Baker, with the group Safe Kids, she's now pushing for federal pool safety legislation. By the way, it would also include state incentive money if the states pass pool safety laws to help pay for some of the new requirements. And it's all because her daughter died in a hot tub at a children's party 5 years ago, and she's made this her mission. Nancy, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, yeesh. Well, still ahead, what's going on in Pakistan? That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. And two former prime ministers are making news in Pakistan. First, Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf is denying reports that he's agreed to step down from his dual role of military chief in an arrangement with exiled former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Bhutto announced yesterday that Musharraf had agreed to leave his military post and that, in turn, all corruption charges, her supporters say trumped-up charges, would be dropped against her. The goal of their ongoing talks is to allow Musharraf to stay as president and to allow Bhutto to return from London to run for prime minister. In a moment, some analysis, but first, Christian Science Monitor correspondent Shahan Mufti is on his cell phone in Islamabad, and we'll get some quick reaction. Shahan, how are Pakistanis reacting to this news that there might be a deal?
Benazir Bhutto supporters, a lot of them are very disappointed that he's sort of cutting a deal with the army, the same army that murdered her father about 20 years ago. So there's a lot of there's a surprise and there's some disappointment in the Benazir Bhutto support camp that people aren't really appreciating her dealing with the army. But at the same time, some people are seeing this as a way, I mean, the only possible way to maintain some semblance of political sanity in the country, I guess. Probably, if I was to guess, it's not going to do a lot of good to Benazir when the elections do come around. People are going to start painting her as pro-American, pro-Musharraf, and all that.
Christian Science Monitor correspondent Shahan Mufti, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Well, you remember this past summer, protesters were calling for Pervez Musharraf to leave office because of his firing of the Supreme Court's Chief Justice, who's since been reinstated. At that time, we spoke with Hussein Haqqani. He's a former Pakistani diplomat and advisor to Benazir Bhutto. He's now director of the International Relations Center at Boston University, and he joins us in the studio. Professor Haqqani, welcome back.
Pleasure being here.
And at that time, you predicted much of this. You said that there would be a negotiated deal and Benazir Bhutto would come back.
Well, what I did say was that there are only two ways out. Either the protests become so strong that General Musharraf has to basically just run away with the shirt on his back, which wasn't likely because the army was still with him and it still is. And the other is some kind of a negotiated transitional arrangement. And I think it's wrong to say that there is an alliance being formed between Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf. What is happening is a discussion about transitional arrangements whereby Musharraf can hang in there with lesser powers and Benazir Bhutto can come back, and so can Nawaz Sharif.
Well, and we should say you are very close with Benazir Bhutto. In fact, some have said perhaps you might play a role in her government. So we say that at the outset, but also because of that, you've been in touch with her. What is she saying about the truth of this deal?
Well, she has confirmed that there is an agreement on certain points. General Musharraf will give up his position as army chief, which is a major issue. Mm-hmm. You can't have the president being the army chief. It's unconstitutional. General Musharraf has two ways of doing it. He can do it as part of an arrangement with Ms. Bhutto and the largest political party, the Pakistan People's Party, or he can do it under the orders of a highly independent Supreme Court. So he would prefer an arrangement. For her part, Ms. Bhutto will get the opportunity of coming back to Pakistan, being able to run for office, things that have been barred by General Musharraf, and Pakistan will get a free and fair election.
Well, what do you say, though, to what we're hearing is going to potentially be criticism of Benazir Bhutto, that this is a deal with the devil?
Indeed, there are people who say that this is a deal with the devil, but the problem is that the army has ruled Pakistan for more than half its existence. It's remained a major institution. There has to be a way in which the army can find a decent and respectable way of going back to the barracks. Ms. Bhutto could be accused of forging a wrong alliance if she actually concedes General Musharraf's right to remain army chief and be president at the same time, only to save her own skin. If she's not doing that, then the criticism will start to dissipate. People will start saying, okay, this is a transitional mechanism for democracy, and then it'll be up to Ms. Bhutto and other politicians to prove that they can actually step up to the plate and perform, because that has been another problem in Pakistan's politics in the past, the performance of civilian leaders.
Well, you mentioned other politicians. This gets complicated further because Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that another exiled former Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, whom Musharraf ousted in the 1999 coup, can also return to Pakistan. He's scheduled, we believe, to return September 10th. He'll also be running in this parliamentary elections. What is his relationship with Bhutto, and how might that affect her dealing with Musharraf?
Well, it's very interesting that until a few months ago, Mr. Sharif and Ms. Bhutto were allies against General Musharraf. They had agreed that they will in future try to keep the army out of Pakistan's politics and that they will not let their own disagreements come in the way of democracy finding roots in Pakistan. At the moment Ms. Bhutto started negotiating with General Musharraf, former Prime Minister Sharif took a harder line. He said, no talks, no negotiation with the army. Ms. Bhutto says, I am still negotiating for democracy. I'm not negotiating to keep General Musharraf in power. I'm negotiating to find the steps towards democracy, to get a free and fair election, and to get a way for you and me, Mr. Sharif and Ms. Bhutto, to come back to the country. I think that Mr. Sharif will go back. He will have some initial positive response from his supporters. But in the end, he will have to make a choice. Does he want to align with those in Pakistan who want Pakistan to finish off the task that General Musharraf has started in fighting Islamist extremism?
By the way, why would Musharraf deny what everyone else is saying is a deal, that he'll step down from his military post?
I think General Musharraf's biggest problem is he does not want to create a situation in which people from his political party that he's created start deserting him before he actually has an arrangement with Ms. Bhutto in place. Mm-hmm. Because the moment he says, I'm stepping down from the military, he shows his weakness. And so if he shows his weakness first and still does not get a deal, he could actually be stabbed in the back and Ms. Bhutto could turn around and say, okay, we got you out of the uniform now, thank you very much, let's move on. So he's actually insuring that against that by denying it till the whole package is agreed to.
And what is it that he might be, you know, using, wanting leverage for? What is it that he might want and not yet have?
Well, what he really wants is the assurance by Ms. Bhutto that her party will vote for him in the presidential election that is supposed to take place, because Ms. Bhutto has not given him any guarantee on that score yet.
Yeah, and it's a parliamentary election, right?
It's a parliamentary election. Various political parties will have seats in parliament. Ms. Bhutto's party is expected to have a large chunk of the seats, Mr. Sharif's another large chunk, and therefore at that time General Musharraf will need a winning coalition of parties. And so what he's trying to do is, okay, I take off the uniform only if you give me an unequivocal commitment that you will vote for me in the presidential election. Ms. Bhutto doesn't want to say that because she does not want to lose the support of the people who right now hate General Musharraf. And so she has to play it very safe. She has to position herself as somebody who's negotiating with somebody she dislikes rather than to say, I'm negotiating with him because I like him and I support him. She doesn't want to acknowledge
or
supporting
because
him.
Because I'm being political and I want his votes.
Exactly. So she basically has to reframe it as an effort to restore democracy in Pakistan.
Hussein Haqqani, former Pakistani diplomat, advisor to Benazir Bhutto. He's now director of the International Relations Center at Boston University. On the news that the former Prime Minister Bhutto and the current President Musharraf of Pakistan are negotiating a deal. Hussein, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
Quick note before the hour's up. Can't get that song out of your head? Well, there's a scientific reason why. Your brain on music in about 6 minutes. You're listening to Here and Now. The secretive kingdom of Saudi Arabia is trying to unravel a mystery within its borders, the death of nearly 2,000 camels. Joining us on the line from Cairo, Egypt, is Scott McLeod, Time Magazine's Cairo Bureau Chief. And Scott, we know you were recently in Saudi Arabia. Describe what's happening.
A few weeks ago, probably at the beginning of August, camels just started mysteriously dying. They're dying fairly quickly after spells of vomiting and kind of angry behavior on the part of the camels. And irritability. At first, there was a concern that it might have been bird flu or some kind of a disease. There are a lot of camel diseases that have been well researched, and the authorities know all about them. They discovered this, first of all, south of Riyadh, the capital, about 200 miles south, which is really the heart of the desert of Saudi Arabia. And then before they knew it, camels started dying in other parts of the country. It was a big mystery, really, at first. When the authorities looked into it, they have discovered it wasn't a disease because it's spreading all over the country now, and it wouldn't have spread so fast if it was bird flu or something like that. And it wouldn't be affecting so many animals at one time. And so what they have pinpointed now is that there was some kind of a poison in the food stock of these animals. And so now the investigation is focusing on what kind of a poison or toxin was in their food. And how did it get there?
Well, and of course, the first thing we think is, when we think pet or livestock food, we think China. Where does the food come from?
As far as I can tell, the food is manufactured in Saudi Arabia. It's not imported stock, but elements of the food might be imported. But it's basically assembled and produced and bagged in a production plant in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi authorities are saying they haven't discovered any problems with the food at the production plant. So they are operating on the hypothesis that the food was poisoned after it left the production facility down the supply route down to the farmers. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty large amount of food that has to go out down the chain, as it were, tons of food going out. Somewhere along the line, this food appears to have been poisoned.
Well, and that could be a careless mistake or ignorance, or it could be something else. Do officials there, and you write that they've launched this sort of CSI probe into this, do they think that there might be an act of terrorism?
Nobody's suggesting it's terrorism or even sabotage at this point. Reading between the lines, they seem to be suggesting that something bad got in by mistake, contaminated this food, and they got to get to the bottom of it. Yeah. But it's a bit of a mystery as to how this happened and or why.
I'm trying to, you know, imagine if 2,000 horses, you know, died suddenly, horrible deaths in, let's say, California, how overwhelming that would be. How are Saudis reacting to this?
Well, they're pretty sad about it. And as you can imagine, the camel owners are really distraught and upset. In a desert country like Saudi Arabia, people love camels, and they've been there for centuries. They are a big part of the culture, and especially the Bedouin culture, which is sort of the foundation of Saudi cultural life. And so they take good care of their camels. They treat them like you might think people would treat horses in terms of the prestige that they give to the animal.
And you write, you know, this isn't some romantic notion that we have. There's 850,000 camels in Saudi Arabia. They ride them. They also eat them. But they're a big part of the culture.
They're a big part of the culture. And by the way, about eating them, the French also eat horse meat. So it's not exactly to say that they don't love them if they're also using them for eating. But they use them more for milk than for eating. But the Bedouin culture is so important in Saudi Arabia that the king of Saudi Arabia issued a proclamation saying that the farmers who raised these camels would be compensated fairly for their losses. The details of that haven't been worked out. I don't think that anybody's gotten a penny out of it yet, but this is a national crisis for Saudi Arabia, and the government is reacting as such.
Scott McCloud, Time Magazine's Cairo Bureau Chief, speaking to us about the mysterious death of about 2,000 camels in Saudi Arabia. Scott, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
By the way, this music is Letter from Home by the Pat Metheny Group. So is your brain tickled? Our next guest explains what happens to us when we hear certain music, including Pat's. This is Your Brain on Music after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There was a time when rock and roll was called the devil's music. And long before that, the Catholic Church banned the interval between the C and F sharp. It's an interval known as the tritone. It's this sound. The augmented fourth, sung there by Tony in West Side Story, was considered so dissonant that it had to be the spawn of Satan, or Diabolus in Musica. Who knew? Music, and how we take it in, that's Daniel Levitin's obsession. A successful studio engineer, Levitin then joined academia, which led him to the study of neuroscience and to his book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, which came out in paperback this week. Here's a reprise of our conversation about music, starting with that evil interval in West Side Story.
I'll never stop saying Maria.
You know, I always thought there was a little something going on when Tony sang that about Maria.
Something devilish in his mind, maybe?
There's something there. In fact, you know, I have always personally had a thing for B flat. Is that possible that notes can spark that reaction in
Absolutely.
Us?
In fact, you know, people who have absolute pitch have different kinds of associations or feeling towards the different notes.
But even those who don't know anything about music, you say, will have reactions to certain kinds of music. For instance, a single high note will make us feel excitement, a single low note, sadness.
There are these general principles that composers know, and of course they don't work all the time for everybody, but they're, you know, as a general principle, high notes convey excitement, low notes convey sadness. Fast notes convey happiness or agitation. Slow notes convey something more ominous or sad.
Right. Major scales, happy. Minor scales, sad. But is this, I mean, are these reactions that we have to music, is this innate or is it cultural? Because different cultures might have different reactions.
Well, that's a good question. Some of it is cultural. So this major minor thing that we're talking about, it's not a cultural universal at all. Middle Eastern culture, there's a lot of minor chords in the music, and they're not all interpreted as sad the way we've learned to interpret them.
Right. And let's give an example here of a major minor. It's the Doors' Light My Fire. It starts in the minor and switches to a major.
The time to hesitate is through. The time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
I like this example because you get the kind of ambiguity of the minor chords during the verse. You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar. And then there's this majestic payoff when Jim Morrison moves to the major key for Come On Baby, Light My Fire.
Right. But in another culture, might somebody have a majestic payoff and it be in a minor?
Absolutely.
Right. Well, something's going on because you write people spend more on music than on sex or prescription drugs. Why? Is there something, the equivalent in music, you know, that compels people the way, you know, you can get addicted to a drug?
Well, music does activate some of the same neural centers as drugs and other pleasurable experiences do. And I draw this out in the book. For example, If you eat chocolate or if you have an orgasm, there's a cluster of neurons that fire, signaling pleasure. And they also fire when you hear music that you like.
Interesting.
Or notes that you like.
And you write, too, that there's something called mirroring, where somebody just watching in the audience, a musician on stage, will have their neurons in the audience will fire in the same way that the person actually playing the music.
This is one of the newest discoveries in cognitive neuroscience, the idea of mirror neurons. They were first discovered by monkeys who were watching other monkeys eat food. And the hands of the monkeys watching another monkey peel a banana, the representation in the brain of their hands started to fire, even though they weren't actually peeling the banana themselves.
Right. So that thing you're feeling in the audience, you really are. When you're playing air guitar, your brain may actually be playing guitar.
That's right.
You say all of our brains, though, are wired to timing. First of all, explain, what do you mean by timing?
We know from memory theorists that almost everything you've experienced is preserved in your brain. And the question is, if you've heard a piece of music many, many times, have you incorporated some regularities of it, the pitch, the rhythm structure, the tempo? And I did an experiment where I just had people come in off the street and sing their favorite pop songs in order to ask the question, are they singing them in the right key and at the right tempo? If their memory has really encoded, like a tape recorder, that song, then they ought to be able to do it. Let's try with you.
Well, here's the thing. We don't have my favorites here, but we did find the White Album from the Beatles. So it's Obladi Oblada, which I think
so
I
So before we play it, then, imagine that it's playing in your head and sing along with that imagination whenever you're ready.
Dun, 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 dun.
So we've got a tempo going, dun, 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 and we've got some pitch. Dun, 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 dun. Now let's go.
Hit it, Doug.
You were right
close.
There.
Was I?
I think so.
All right, everybody.
I lost track of what you were doing before it came on.
Well, that's later. And what does it say to you?
Well, the tempo is really interesting because you could have sung it at any speed, and you sang it very, very close to the actual. You were a little bit faster, but that's
I'm
normal.
I'm nervous.
Yeah, well, that's normal. You're a little nervous. You haven't sung on national radio a lot.
In a week. but what does that say to you, that people, what, that they... That...
Well, it says something about memory. We remember aspects of the world with high fidelity, if you will, with great resolution and accuracy.
You say that artists like Pink Floyd's Dave Gilmour, Pat Metheny, use multiple delays of signal to stimulate our brains. And what do you mean by that? Because we want to hear, let's listen in a moment to a little of Dave Gilmour. We have
well,
that. But what do you mean by that?
This is something I first heard when I was living here in Boston and I was a student at Berkeley. And I would go up to Central Square and hear Pat Metheny play every chance I could get. And he had this sound I had never heard before. It was his guitar sound was just different. And I asked him about it, and he had this rack of equipment called digital delays, which were brand new at the time. And what they do is they delay the sound like this, 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 this.
Hmm.
So if you were talking, you could adjust how you want the repeat to be. And he and Dave Gilmour at Pink Floyd have made this part of their arsenal of sounds that they use.
And what does that do to us, the listener?
Well, it does something funny to the brain because the brain has evolved over tens of thousands of years living in natural environments, not listening to electronic machines. So when the brain hears that, it's trying to figure out where that comes from, and the only reference it has is thousands of years of living in caves and in closed spaces. And we used our sense of delay to help navigate in the dark in these caves. So the brain is sort of fooled into thinking that we're in some funny acoustic space, and of course we're not. And I think it's an interesting thing for the brain. It's kind of like a tickle.
Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, out in paperback this week. And we know, I may have been close on the tempo on Obladi Oblada, but man, I was way off pitch, as many of you pointed out the first time this story aired.
Ordinary men.
Floyd. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.